Accession number 27460, Reel 18.
Reel 18. We're talking about real the living conditions in which you now found yourselves. What about the weather and the climate at this time?
At this time, it was very hot and humid at nights. But the rains hadn't started. We hadn't got to that stage yet. So we were coping.
Was it a debilitating kind of climate? It drained you?
Yes. If you were digging in, it was exhausting.
And you mentioned some of the tablets you took. Was salt tablets amongst the items they gave you?
Not at this stage. And also, we were rather lucky because we were getting most nights... We were able to have a mug of cocoa, but for some reason or other, the chaps didn't like it and complained, and I think there'll be quite a lot of tins of cocoa buried down in the Aragon.
Oh. Night time, could you get to sleep easily?
No. No, I think... over a period of time, because we did used to hear small arms in different areas, and the method that we had, if there was anything nearby, we stood to, and we used to time the stand to, and we, provided we weren't attacked, which we weren't, we would stand to for 1 hour, or 1 hour after the last shots were heard. And so that robbed us of quite a lot of sleep.
This must have played, on your exhaustion and your nerves and so forth.
It did, yes. Having said that, it stood me in good stead for years later, because when I came home, we had a family. I never had to go through the process of waking up. I was either sound asleep or wide awake in a flash. If the children moved in their cots, I was wide awake.
What about effect upon your temper, or people's tempers around you? Were they short tempered?
No, everyone. We seemed as though we got on fine amongst ourselves. Occasionally someone did flare up, but not often.
You mentioned the first attack, which we've discussed already, of course. Were the Japs pretty active in trying to infiltrate into your positions?
They were, yes. If it wasn't us, it was somewhere else. And it was quite common on a morning at breakfast time to be warned not to go back down the line. The Japs had cut the road behind us.
Had you had anyone telling you the Jap tactics, Jap situation when you first arrived? I'm thinking in terms of, calling out in English and this kind of thing, if they were close to you.
Well, we'd heard all about this before we actually went into action. But we'd only been in action a few days when we got a visit from Lord Louis Mountbatten. And he gathered us round. He didn't want us all lined up. We had to gather round him. And he gave us a very good appraisal of the war as it was going at the time and our situation as it was in particular. And he told us, he said, we've got four-wheel drive vehicles and we're going to fight through the monsoon. He said, we're going to beat the Jap at his own game, and we will.
Did he impress you?
Very much. I've heard his talk on television, and I know he had rehearsed that talk word for word. It was word perfect, because on the documentaries and things, you can see him start off with the soldiers. He'll be giving it to the Navy or someone, and you can recognise the whole talk wherever he gave it. So it was a well-rehearsed talk, but at least it did some good. He told us we were going to get this and that, and it would help us.
Can you carry on now with your memories of being in this situation, this position?
Yes. Well, whilst we were down there, and I can't just remember which order these things came, but we were in, our regiment was involved in the capture of the tunnels in the Mayu Range. The capture of Mondor and Boothie Dong. We took all that. And we moved to another position which virtually backed onto the Razabul fortress, and we got into it through a little narrow valley, very short valley, between some hills, and that got out onto the paddy fields, and we had one of our gun positions on the paddy fields, and it was rather an amusing thing that occurred here. It had been very hot, and I was allocated a position on the edge of this little valley, about 20 yards up the hill, to defend it should the Japs try and make an entrance. Now, the infantry was on the other side, and we dug in and dug our sleeping quarters out, but we hadn't got dug down too far when this particular night I got up to relieve the chap in front of me, and as I went into the defence post, the same chap that had told me about the snake, he was on duty, and he handed over the Bren gun, the bottle of lime juice and everything, and the grenades, and we both looked over the gun position across the paddy fields, and this huge black cloud was coming towards us. And so this chap's name was Gossage. I said, "Well, Goss," I said, "there's one of two things will happen." I said, "If that bloody cloud bumps this hill," I said, "we'll be washed out." I said, "if those guns fire before it does, we'll still be washed out." Well, I don't think he'd be into his bed more than a quarter of an hour after I had relieved him, when I heard the tannoys crackle over the gun positions to take post. I heard the fire orders come down. I heard the shells getting slammed into the breaches, and the sergeants reporting their guns ready. And then I heard the countdown to zero and the order to fire. So I'm not quite sure. The cloud was right above me, whether the cloud actually bumped our hill or whether it was the guns, but the heavens opened. And our dugout was flooded. But there was another dugout right on top of the hill above us. And a lot of their stuff, the force of the rain coming down, washed steel helmets, bestins and mugs, plates, all sorts of things down the hillside. Newspapers, there'd been a delivery of mail that day. Newspapers and all sorts came tumbling down. And this storm would last possibly 15 minutes. I know the guns just about stood easy when the rain stopped, and we were knee-deep in water in our dugout. Beds flooded, everything. And, of course, we had to be extra vigilant at the time when the guns were firing, because that was the time when the Japanese would make their attack to try and get to the guns. So we were really on top form watching. Never mind, one of the chaps in our amongst our my team, he would set to and try and dig a hole out through the side of the dugout down the hillside to drain, and were bailing with empty 4-gallon petrol tins. And so someone would relieve me while I tried to salvage some of my bedding. And I was nudged and told to look out at one of my team, a fellow whose name was Thomas, and he was from the Swansea Valley. And someone thought he'd gone crackers. He was standing there, he had this magazine in his hands. I think it was an Everybody's Weekly. And he was tittering to himself. And of course, the moon was bright, and it was a beautiful silhouette. Well, it was clear, he wasn't just a silhouette, he was beautiful. And so I jumped out of the trench and went to him to pull him down and get him under cover. And when I went to him, I said, "What the hell are you laughing at?" And he just turned the book to me like that, and there across the pages was an article about the Swansea Valley from where he originated, and the heading was, "Do you know what it means to live in a good home?" So it was very appropriate. I got him undercover.
Am I right that you provided your own defence for your headquarters situation? The infantry would be ahead of you or elsewhere.
Oh well, every unit provided its own defence. You were isolated in a way, but you weren't, and that was the reason I think our colonel liked to have us close to the infantry, so that they could support us.
Was this the beginning of the rainy season that we've now reached?
Not really, no. We had time. There was, because we were still down at this position for a short while. Now, while we were in that position, it was a case of, on an evening after I'd finished my work, I used to try to get washed and cleaned up before our evening meal, because we had to put on our longer clothes, and there would be the Mepocrine parade and everything, so you didn't have time to get washed and cleaned up after the meal. So this particular day, I'd gone up, but I hadn't actually got undressed. Well, I didn't have much to... I was stripped to the waist to start with. And Mr. Bell, a lieutenant in headquarters, came over, and he wanted the adjutant's driver, who was already stripped off and washing himself from head to foot, because with the dust blowing and perspiring, the dust used to settle on the body, and it used to turn abrasive where it got into the creases of the body, under the chin, etc. We used to tie a handkerchief round our neck to act as a means of safeguarding it a bit, but we used to sweat so much, sometimes you could actually see the sweat dropping off the lower corner. Anyway, Mr. Bell wanted the adjutant's driver, who was stripped, and so I immediately volunteered to drive him, and he wanted an escort as well, so another of the men would come. And we had to drive round to a position which we'd vacated previously. I gathered the gist of what was happening when we got there, because as we arrived at the position, there was a jeep standing at the entrance with a lieutenant colonel sitting there looking absolutely miserable, legs hanging out of the jeep, and our officer went up and checked with him that he was the commanding officer of the 6th Mediums, and Mr. Bell said to him that we had, division or corps, had been unable to contact them, and he was very rude and told them to F off, and that. I felt sorry for Mr. Bell, because I don't think any person should speak to a subordinate in that way. But anyway, That was it. But Mr. Bell pursued his objective, and he finally managed to get it through to the colonel that there was going to be a big battle that night, a big artillery barrage, and we had brought the fire orders over for him to obey. However, the colonel was reluctant to accept all this, but anyway, Mr. Bell finally said, "Well, look, I'll go back and report what the situation is," because the colonel stated that they were trying to get back over the Naukidok Pass. Some of their gun tractors being knocked out, all their wirelesses, and they'd no means of communication. Mr. Bell said, "Right," he said, "well, we'll go back, and if there are any changes to the orders, then we'll let you know." So then the colonel said, "What is the password tonight?" Well, of course, we'd left before the password had been issued for that night. So the colonel said, "OK, we'll make it Niagara," answered by Falls. So we set off back to our own position, and I saw Mr. Bell sitting there looking very dejected, and I offered that if there was a message to be brought back, I would be willing to bring it back. So Mr. Bell thanked me and heard no more till later on that night. I'd actually gone to bed. I thought, you know, they'll not bother anymore. Anyway, when I was already in bed, and I heard my name being whispered, and I was out of bed with Mr. Bell. He wanted me to take this message back to the colonel. So he told me to take the adjutant's truck, and I had to take the driver and an escort. So we hung three grenades on each of us, and we had our small arms, and we must not let these fire orders get into enemy hands under any condition. So as we made our way to the truck, the driver of the truck said to me, "Would I like to drive?" Well, I did prefer. I trained him to drive the previous year, but I think they put a bit of confidence in me, and so I would drive the truck, and they would stand. Of course, it was better for them being stood up in the back. If anything had happened, they were in a better position than I was. I was trapped in the front. Anyway, as we tried to get out of the position, the infantry had a terrific barbed wire entanglement across the road, and we had to get that pulled up before we could get out. And so we put it back loosely, so it was still a defence, but it would be easy for us when we came back. So we set off and we went along to the position. We got to the position, and if we'd been Japanese, we could have blown them all to hell, because they were not taking any precautions. I think they thought they were safe. They probably were. But the Razabul Fortress wasn't far up the road.
The Japanese held it, didn't they?
The Japanese held the Razabul Fortress. It was a stronghold. So, anyway, we got the message delivered, and one of these characters that was with me, he said to me, he says, "And no stopping at any dark corners." I think they were on edge. So we set off, and of course, what did I do? I took the wrong track. And I landed down, entering the Razabul Fortress. Of course, we were welcomed with a hail of small arms fire. And as one of the chaps told a person many years later, he said, "I've never seen a person turn a Dodge 1500 weight truck round as sharp as I had that night." Because the track was a little bit higher than the paddy fields at the side and very narrow, and I'd had to turn it round on that and round, and under fire. But there were rotten shots, nothing hit us, and we got away. And then when we thought we'd got all the barbed wire entanglement pulled up to get back into our own position, we'd missed some and it got entangled around the propeller shaft, and that brought us to a halt. Because I couldn't see in the dark. And so I had to get underneath the truck with barbed wire cutters and set to feeling everything and cutting, feel and cut, till I got the vehicle freed. And then we pulled through and we put the entanglement up again and got back into our own position. Quite an experience.
Was that the closest you'd come so far to being shot at?
Yes. I think it was. Apart from that position where the hill was, there was a sniper on that hillside, and he fired a shot that went right between two of us that were going down into the cookhouse, down into the ravine. We both heard it whistle past us, each thought the other had got it, but it went past.
What happened next?
Oh, well, then we moved from this position again, and we went back to our original position, and we're in that position. Mind you, we'd partaken quite a few skirmishes, battles, or whatever, and we're in that position when I think we'd been down on the Arakan about 5 weeks. This particular day, there was a light aircraft flew over our headquarters, and I know I was in the process of just finishing servicing the regimental headquarters office truck, which was a proper office laid out. And anyway, this aircraft came over and threw a package out. Now, headquarters must have been expecting this, because the regimental clerk went out, retrieved the package, and during lunch we were told that we were going to be moving out, but just pack up discreetly, because the Japs can still see us, and we'll be moving out after dark. So that was what we did. We, when it got dark, we moved out and we set off down to Chittagong. That was a long journey back down the line, and picked up regimental headquarters, B echelon and everything, and we got down to Chittagong, where we changed some of our vehicles. We said goodbye to the office truck, which I'd just serviced. Oh, I put some hard work into doing that, make it just spot on. Our Bedford two-wheel drive water wagon was replaced with a four-wheel drive Ford water wagon. Now, these, I think, were being built by the Tata Steel Company in India. I think they would manufacture the chassis and various bits, but the engines and transmissions and that would come from America or Canada, because it was a right-hand drive. So we got these, and some of our Austin 3-tonners were taken off us, and they were replaced with Chevrolet four-wheel drive 3-tonners. So we spent, I think, about another 24 hours at Chittagong getting things handed over, and we set off then on a long journey, which was to take a week. We travelled up to a place called Shillong. Now, it's reputed to be the wettest place in the world, and I think I'd go along with that. The journey up to Shillong was very hard. The road was narrow, one-way traffic, and the first night up that road rained and rained, and we got no sleep. We got eventually up to Shillong, and we got out of Shillong and down again to the other side. We're heading for Dimapur. We had to cross the river, I think at a place called Pandu. I know the deck of the ferry was very wet, and one of our gun tractors was unable to stop as he went, because they were going cross over the ferry. And when he applied the brakes, he just slid down the greasy deck and straight down into the water. The driver couldn't swim, but the sergeant dived in and pulled him out. The wagon was recovered by our light aid detachment, and it was everything cleaned out, and it joined us a few days later. We travelled to Dimapur, and we'd hardly got into Dimapur when I could hear them shouting for the recce parties. They were going straight out, and we moved out of Dimapur just for a short distance, and it was from there that the recce parties went and returned, and then we moved up the road. Now, if my memory serves me right, there was a milestone 18, and every time you passed that milestone, there was this awful smell. And it was some time later that I discovered what the smell was. And apparently the Japanese had got as far as this. And the Japanese had jumped off the hillside with a grenade, hoping to drop it into the turret of a tank. Missed his footing, and he was rolled out, as someone said, like a piece of pastry on the road. But his one foot had been severed just above the ankle and was still in the boot and was in the ditch. And so it was a combination of the pastry and the foot that was creating this awful smell. We went up to a position about the 26th milestone up the Kohima Road, and we couldn't get all our vehicles onto the position, and those that couldn't go onto the position had to be dug in on the roadside, nose on into the hillside, to give the engine and radiator and everything like that a bit of safety. They were dug into properly prepared places. I think the engineers had dug them out, and the engineers with their bulldozers had dug gun positions for us. Of course, the rains had started. It wasn't torrential at the start, the first day we were there, but it did rain very heavily after that.
What date was this?
I'm not quite sure, but I think it was sometime in April.
This is 1944?
Oh, yes, 1944, yes.
Had the roads you come up, had they been in good condition? Or?
Yes, the engineers had laid metalled roads, and that was a great help. They weren't very wide, but they were wide enough. We came up this road. Now, the bulldozers bulldozed a track along the hillside so that our headquarters was off the roadside inside the position, and then they bulldozed a steep track down the hill and then another track out onto the road, so it came out onto the road about a couple of hundred yards below the entrance. And the method of getting out of this position, if the vehicle was in, we had a vehicle stationed on the top with a winch, so that we could let the vehicles down the slope on the winch to get out, because it was just terribly greasy.